From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA senior political analyst, Brian Padden. Our topic on this edition of the program, pandemic politics. Our guest, one of the foremost experts on the U.S. political system, Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. That's a prominent policy group based here in Washington. And Mr. Ornstein is a longtime observer and analyst of American politics and the U.S. Congress. He's the author of many books, including the bestseller One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. He also wrote the acclaimed book with E.J. Dionne and Thomas E. Mann entitled It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Norman Ornstein was elected fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2004. He has been interviewed on almost every cable and network news outlet in the United States. His many opinion editorials and articles are featured in a wide variety of publications, such as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, to name a few. We will talk with Norman Ornstein about a variety of topics dominating the U.S. political landscape, particularly as the United States grapples with the COVID-19 crisis. For example, what are the roles and responsibilities of the federal and state governments in managing a national emergency of this magnitude? The New York Times and Washington Post extensively documented Washington's late and slow response to the coronavirus pandemic. When government experts urged U.S. President Donald Trump to systematically use the Defense Production Act early on to compel U.S. companies to produce supplies and equipment, such as test kits and personal protective equipment needed by frontline healthcare workers, he demurred. Critics said that Mr. Trump should have used the prodigious coordinating, purchasing, and logistical power at the federal government's disposal to assist the varying needs of the 50 states. And many state governors, who otherwise would not be known to Americans, have become household names given their leadership. Governor Andrew Cuomo of the state of New York, Governor Larry Hogan of the state of Maryland, or Gretchen Whitmer, a rising star in the Democratic Party and governor of the state of Michigan. We'll talk with Norman Ornstein about the politics of the pandemic and issues surrounding the general election in November. The one and only Norman Ornstein joins us via Skype as we all practice social distancing from his home in Washington. Norman, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Carol.
And I'm delighted, of course, to welcome my colleague, Brian Padden.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, Norman, first off, let me ask you about the role of the federal government versus the states. Please delineate for us the role of the federal and state governments in our federal system, but especially during a national pandemic. As I alluded to, tensions have been mounting between U.S. governors and President Trump about who should do what. How would you assess the administration's leadership and coordination of those roles in its response to the pandemic?
Well, first, as a general matter, Carol, the federal government, certainly in the 20th century and into the 21st, whenever there is a natural disaster or a man-made disaster, takes a central role. We have the Federal Emergency Management Administration that's part of the federal government that ends up coordinating relief. We usually get federal funds that flow to particular states. If there's a hurricane, for example, or a flood or a major fire or a disaster of that sort. When we've had epidemics or pandemics in the past, the federal government has also played a significant role, but always in coordination with states, which also coordinate with their own local governments. And that's what we saw, for example, with Hurricane Katrina, the devastating one that hit New Orleans and other areas down in our south back during the Bush administration. What's happened with this pandemic is somewhat different and unusual. First, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, which has this expertise in coordinating disasters, in other words, understands how you can get the appropriate emergency equipment together in a central place and get it sent down to where it's most needed, was absent for months at the start of all of this. And at the same time, the president basically washed his hands of much of the coordinating effort and left it to the states to decide how they were going to respond with their hospitals, with the necessary ventilators, with the personal protective equipment. And what made it worse and different from most is that the states themselves had to go out onto the open market and buy equipment where they needed it. But that meant they were competing against each other and driving up the prices. And when the federal government got involved in this process, instead of taking on the role of buying all the equipment, using its purchasing power to keep the prices down, it went against the states. And when the federal government would win those bids with more money, it would then send the equipment to private enterprise, which then sold it to the states. So it's made this process more difficult because the coordination that always has a little bit of give and take. Governors want to have a central role, but also want the federal money. The federal government wants to be able to control what it does with its money and resources. And there may be different views on how to handle a particular crisis, but usually they're subordinated to the urgent needs of the crisis itself. And this time, what we've seen is more competition and tension and friction than what we're used to in these kinds of crises.
Just a quick follow-up. What about the so-called Defense Production Act? Many analysts are saying that this would have been the ideal time to invoke the Defense Production Act. Now, Mr. Trump, I believe, did it for ventilators, again, a little bit late in the game, but he was reluctant to use it and has been systematically. Why do you think that's the case? And could it have made a difference, perhaps, in producing the personal protective equipment and other vital supplies necessary in a more efficient manner that may have even mitigated the economic downturn?
I think there's no question that the failure to invoke the Defense Production Act was a mistake and has been costly in a whole host of ways. What the Defense Production Act does, and it's of course something that is meant for times of war or catastrophe, is that you can require from the federal government manufacturers to turn their manufacturing effort to produce the things that are in most urgent need. And in the end, very much delayed, when President Trump said he would invoke the Defense Production Act, but actually didn't. General Motors and the Ford Motor Company, companies that, of course, make automobiles and automotive parts, were going to be ordered to turn much of their manufacturing facilities over to making ventilators. General Motors ended up doing it itself without having the Defense Production Act invoked. But the early problems that we had, especially in places like New York, and to a degree, California, where we had this tremendous surge in cases and the hospitals were simply unable to handle it. Then when that dies down, you can move the equipment to elsewhere where it's needed the most. But we had a shortage when it was most needed and no quick action to begin to get those ventilators produced. Right now, what we have is a tremendous shortage of much of the personal protective equipment that we want for people who work in hospitals and medical facilities as those with the COVID-19 virus come in. And we have had dramatic shortages of the N95 masks, the gowns, also the parts that go with the ventilators that are required to do the intubation. And the failure to move more quickly on that has meant that we've had to rely on foreign manufacturers, which themselves have been overloaded, and that also has driven up the prices. What made it worse is that, for reasons that are baffling, the administration sent millions of pieces of protective equipment to China, which is where most of the manufacturing is taking place, when they were needed here. And when we had that surge and didn't have the equipment, we had empty warehouses. So the level of ineptitude in understanding the magnitude of the problem, in trying to get ahead of the problem, but also making mistakes along the way that have exacerbated the problem, is just not like anything we've seen in disaster in our lifetimes.
Brian Padden.
Mr. Ornstein, why do you think the Trump administration is not taking a stronger role? Is it an ideological position where they feel that the state should be taking the primary role? Or is it political that they don't want to be held responsible for when things go wrong?
I think it's more the latter than it is the former. Of course, what we know is with Republicans and conservatives, there is this general framework where they would rather have government done more at the local and state level than at the federal level. But this isn't really about that. And we have a couple of reasons to believe it's not about that. One is the own words daily in what are the press conferences where he's participated that have ended up being more like political rallies in many ways. But it is a president who says almost every day, I take no responsibility for what's going on, and tries to foist it off on the governors, but also has given much more assistance to governors who've praised him regularly and denied that assistance to governors who have been more blunt about what they need and the failure to get it. I think the second part of this is that we have a president who knows that it's going to get worse, who early on was so concerned about the state of the economy and the stock market that he downplayed the virus and said it would all go away very quickly. Now, when it's fairly clear that it's not happening, and while many of the people in his administration have issued these guidelines, and what we've seen with so many other countries and what we know is effective when you don't have a vaccine is the social distancing, that what we're seeing is a president who has issued guidelines, or at least accepted the guidelines that we maintain the social distancing, but then has encouraged insurgent demonstrations in many states that demand opening things up. Now, we know what the guidelines are that the health officials and the administration have themselves set. You do not want to open up away from the extreme social distancing until you've had at least 14 days without a significant outbreak of cases of COVID-19, because we know 14 days is the incubation period. After that, maybe you can move a little bit towards having a greater openness while still maintaining that 6-foot difference that they've recommended. But what we're seeing is the president lauding governors in states like Georgia that have called for opening up in places that are some of the most dangerous. But there hasn't been that 14-day period where the incubation would show that you don't have so much danger anymore. And what we're seeing is a political dimension to this. And in particular, it's praising Republican governors in states that are not following the president's own guidelines and encouraging demonstrations and incitement against mostly Democratic governors who are trying to follow specifically and precisely the guidelines set by the administration. The president is not doing what his own medical people have recommended in a lot of ways. And that's just very different, again, from what we've seen with previous presidents and with previous crises.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Norman Ornstein, author and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, specializing in politics, elections, and the U.S. Congress. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA senior political analyst Brian Padden. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to all our loyal listeners in Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We want to hear from you. Let us know that you're listening and how you're coping with the coronavirus pandemic in your country. Well, back to our program with Norman Ornstein. And how about another question from Brian Padden?
Can we turn to the election campaign that is underway here? Yep. The coronavirus pandemic has turned the whole campaign both procedurally and thematically upside down. We thought we knew what some of the major issues were going into this campaign, that President Trump was going to try to make it about his stewardship of a strong economy, and the Democrats were going to try to talk about things like health care. What's this election about now?
Of course, our presidential elections, when there's an incumbent running for re-election, are usually framed around a referendum on the incumbent. Does this incumbent president deserve re-election? Are things good enough? Have they improved enough over the course of that presidential term that you think another 4 years is merited or not? We're going to have that, but it's probably not going to be about stewardship of the economy. It may not be just simply based on the rather tribal divisions that we have in our politics. People who may not be thrilled with everything that Donald Trump has done, but do not want the other side to win. Now it's going to be, at least from today's perspective, far more about the handling of this pandemic and the aftermath of the pandemic. Now, we're in uncharted territory here in a couple of ways. One is, we've seen just recently that the head of the Centers for Disease Control, Robert Redfield, said that we could expect very possibly another severe outbreak in the fall. We know that viruses of this sort thrive during colder periods, tend to decline during the warmer periods. We may see a bit of a recovery through the summer months, but remember our election is the early part of November. So if we get another major outbreak, one, it could have a very significant effect on how people feel about Donald Trump and his stewardship, but two, it may complicate the election. And this is something that we've seen already in some of our primary elections, some of which were postponed or even come close to being canceled, others of which have had havoc because voters could not do what they would normally do, go to the polls to vote, where you'd be gathered together in large numbers and packed together. How that will work out, we're just not sure. Now, I would say at this point, though, that the way in which this virus has gone and what it has done is bad news for Donald Trump in terms of his reelection. We're seeing in some of the surveys that he is losing significant support among older voters. We're going to see what happens in states that have been very strong for him in the past, where they are opening up more now. And it may be that that reckless behavior by the governors of these states, and I mean places like Florida, South Carolina, Georgia, those may create a backlash, and that could hurt the president's reelection chances as well. On the other side, the likely Democratic nominee, the presumptive Democratic nominee running against Donald Trump, Joe Biden, was denied the victory and the attention that would have come through all of these primaries where he was sweeping through. We may not be able to have regular conventions. We may end up with virtual conventions this summer. They've already been postponed. The Democratic convention that was supposed to be in July now moved to August. And that's always a big event, put a focus on the presidential nominee. And of course, what's also happened during this time is that for Joe Biden, all the oxygen has been taken away by Donald Trump, and to a degree as well by Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York, who's been holding a daily briefing because New York has been the epicenter of this virus. And that's left little room for Biden. Now, that's not as big a problem as a lot of Democrats who have been upset that Biden is nowhere to be found by and large, although he has been holding town halls and doing other things. This is not a time when people are focused on politics, and that won't come until the late summer and early fall. But everything surrounding the election has been shaped now by this pandemic and what will follow.
Just on that point, you were saying this is a referendum. That was another strategy that the Trump administration was trying to make this less of a referendum and more of a choice and put the focus of Trump versus Biden. Because of the pandemic and because of Biden being out of the spotlight, does this amplify the issue of a referendum over a choice in the upcoming election? And does that work in Biden's favor?
I would say that there are a couple of elements of this that work in Biden's favor. The first is this makes it much more of a referendum. And it's a referendum in part because Donald Trump, through 3 years, didn't really have a significant crisis on his hands. There were small things. This is a huge thing. And what we're seeing now is, in the middle of a crisis, how well a president can manage it. And managing it on a number of different frames. One is how well you manage the ability to rally the country behind you, to show your empathy for those who are dying, who are out of work, who are disrupted by all of this. That's not a strong suit of Donald Trump. And he has been more divisive than uniting in that front. A second is whether you're ahead of the game, you understand what the problem is, and you react early. That's not been good for Trump either. And the third element is whether you have a well-oiled machine in your government and your administration. Do you have the best people in charge? Are you giving them the leeway that they need to do what they need to do? While there are some impressive career people, mostly in the administration, the prime one being somebody now called frequently America's doctor, Anthony Fauci, who's the chief infectious disease person, they have been held back, if not muzzled, by President Trump. And this has not been a very effective response. Now, for Joe Biden, one of the things that he is going to be able to do is to show the team that he would have around him if another crisis emerged. One of his great strengths here is that a former chief of staff of his, Ron Klain, was actually the person in charge of dealing with the Ebola outbreak in the Obama administration and did a masterful job. So he's got a contrast there that he can draw. At the same time, for all of Biden's drawbacks, his age, the fact that he stumbles over words sometimes, that he seems on occasion confused, that he can be verbose, the greatest strength that Biden has, other than his deep experience in governance, including in the White House itself as vice president, is his empathy. This is a man who suffered in his family more than anybody could imagine, losing his young wife and daughter when he was not quite 30 years of age, right before he came to the Senate, then losing his son who had survived but was in the hospital for months after that particular accident, Beau, to brain cancer. Biden has a natural empathy for people that he shows. And so both as a referendum on Trump, but also as a choice, given what we're seeing as a window into how the Trump administration operates, that is going to work to Biden's advantage. It doesn't mean that this election is over. It is by no means over. Lots of things can happen, and we don't know how the election itself will be carried out. But right now, Biden has a very strong matchup against Trump.
Norman, I wanted to follow up on how the election will be carried out. First of all, quick question. The general election cannot be postponed. Is that correct?
That is correct. We have provisions in the Constitution and the law that set dates. There are specific dates, for example, on when our electors meet. That's in the Constitution, on when the new Congress convenes, on when they count the electoral votes. It is in the Constitution that the new president gets inaugurated at noon on January 20th, and that means the president who's been in office is no longer in office as of noon on that day. Election Day itself is set by law. It's an 1845 law that set it on the first Tuesday following the first Monday in November. There is nothing that enables a president in law or the Constitution to postpone that election or to handle it in a different way. Now, there's a caveat here. The elections are still managed by the states, and governors in many states have the ability to shut down polling places. They have some flexibility in how they handle the administration of the election. But governors, for an election of a president or of a senator or of a member of Congress, have no authority to say, I'm sorry, we're going to have a do-over election at another point. So the election goes forward on that first Tuesday following the first Monday in November this year. But how it gets carried out is anybody's guess.
You said earlier, notwithstanding the fact that President Trump may not have a very well-oiled government machinery, notwithstanding Dr. Anthony Fauci, he has great motivation to win. And he's concerned because he doesn't have the strong economy that he wanted to run on before. That has been forced to close down. Maybe it's not his fault per se, but this is what we're dealing with, voting in the age of the coronavirus pandemic. But he does have quite a campaign chest, as does the Republican Party. And Mr. Biden is a little behind on that. So the question to you is, are you worried, Norman Ornstein, about the legitimacy and fairness of the upcoming general election? Do you believe that there will be an opportunity to expand, for example, early voting? Many states already have that. What about mail-in ballots, absentee ballots? Many states still have that, but it's just state by state. I think many people on both sides of the aisle would like to know that there are mechanisms in place to expand the franchise because there's so much at stake in this election. How do you see that, and what do you see are the impediments? Will there be pushback by Republicans, particularly Republicans who feel that mail-in ballots causes more fraud, although the evidence doesn't really support that? How do you see it playing out?
It's interesting and ironic in some ways. Republicans used to benefit more from absentee balloting than Democrats and resisted any effort to put restrictions on it or to deal with issues that might be there of fraud. They were concerned about voting at the polls. Now there's a belief that mail-in ballots benefit Democrats, and so they've resisted, and we've seen instances, the primary election in Wisconsin that we just had, where the Republican legislature, the Republican-led court in Wisconsin, basically tried to limit those votes by mail and actually rather recklessly forced many people to go to the polls when there was a danger of getting infected with the virus. What we're seeing now is a battle over whether funds will go to the Postal Service, which is very close to bankruptcy right now. And of course, we're not going to be able to easily have voting by mail if we don't have a Postal Service to be able to pick up and deliver those ballots. So we're going to continue to struggle over this. We are seeing some responses at local levels, and it varies very much, you're right, by state. But just as an example, in Wisconsin, where the biggest city is Milwaukee, it's a Democratic stronghold. That's where the Republicans cut the number of polling places down from 70 to 5 for this primary election, which meant people had to congregate even more. But the city of Milwaukee now has said that they're going to mail out absentee ballots to every one of the 300,000 voters in the city with free postage for return. So we may see some responses of that sort. But real questions over the legitimacy of the election will remain, and especially if Trump believes he's losing and some of the things that he might try to do, including using his emergency powers, say, to shut down voting in some cities that are Democratic areas, but not in areas that are more Republican. We're vigilant and have to worry a great deal about those things. I would end just by saying there's an irony here in all of this. I have a dear friend who is American but lives in Australia. There's a conservative government in Australia, conservative Prime Minister Scott Morrison. He reacted in a very different way early on, getting ahead of this, using a much stronger level of social distancing, making sure that Australia had the right equipment. They have had many fewer deaths, even though this early action was costly and was controversial. And his approval rating has soared. Donald Trump, looking at the immediate term, how do I get the stock market up in the next week? How do I get the economy moving in the next month? Has taken a set of actions that may backfire at the worst possible time for him. And of course, it's meant more deaths, more instances of people getting the virus. And instead of looking at the long term and how he could have improved his standing, and he might have ensured his own reelection if he had done the right things at an early point, to gain a short-term advantage, he's taken what could be a catastrophic long-term loss.
And of course, many say the key to opening up the economy would be ramping up nationwide testing in a much more vigorous manner than it is now. And he talks the talk, but it doesn't seem that he's delivering on that. So if he really wants to open the economy, that seems to me, and to many others, which is more important, the way to do it.
You cannot open up the economy without having the ability to not just test, but to track people and make sure that they're not going to areas where there is the possibility of contamination and of the virus. That means you need massive testing. You need massive availability of no-touch thermometers. You need to have all kinds of other things in place. And the testing capability that could have been there and should have been there has not been there. The president in his conferences every day keeps saying, we've tested more than any other country. Well, we have more population. And if you look at it on a per capita basis, our testing has been, frankly, pathetic.
And Norm, of course, with respect to the national election in November, I think people don't want to have to choose between their health and their constitutional right to vote. So everybody's hoping that more flexible voting options will be available.
I'm part of a task force working on trying to make sure that that could happen. You know, one of the things that we have is for overseas voters and for military voters, you can get an absentee ballot and print it out yourself if it doesn't arrive in the mail. One of the things that happened in Wisconsin, in part because they just didn't have the personnel working in the election offices, is people who requested an absentee ballot to be sent to them with ample time never got them. And that meant they couldn't use that vote by mail option. If you can print one out yourself, then you're not going to have to worry about a backlog of that sort. And getting that available to voters, but also making sure that the states and the localities have enough personnel and the expertise to be able to take in the flood of ballots that they're not used to getting by mail and counting them in a timely way. These are all things that we should be dealing with now, and you would hope that Congress and the states, some states are doing it, Congress has not been, would be looking ahead to try and make sure that it can work in a fashion that is required. We don't have a democracy if we don't have a full and fair election, and that should be a top priority right now.
Norman Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, an author, and one of the foremost experts on the American political system. Norm, thanks so much for your excellent insights, and it was a terrific conversation.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. And joining me on the program was VOA senior political analyst Brian Padden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.